From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Scientists have unearthed a 3-million-year-old skull that helps piece together the story of human evolution. On today's Fresh Air, we meet paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson, who heads the team that discovered the nearly complete skull. In 1974, Johansson discovered Lucy, the oldest skeleton of our erect-walking human ancestors. Also today, we continue our conversation about the inequities of our tax system with Donald Bartlett and James Steele, the Pulitzer Prize-winning authors of the book America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? And commentator Ed Ward reports from Berlin, where he's having trouble adjusting to shop hours. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United States has released its annual review of foreign trade barriers. It finds 35 nations are not trading U.S. goods well. The lion's share of the report focuses on Japan. The government says Japanese trade barriers far exceed those of any other major industrial country. This report is especially important because President Clinton has revived the Super 301 trade law. This lets the administration impose severe tariffs on imports from foreign countries. These tariffs would equal the amount lost in U.S. sales. President Clinton has also signed education legislation into law. This legislation is called Education Goals 2000. It sets forth a list of national education goals and authorizes nearly $650 million this year in educational reforms. The president says this will help local schools act on their own initiative.
We're going to try something new. We're going to have world-class standards implemented with grassroots reforms. We're going to give more waivers and cut the red tape to districts who want to try new and different and innovative things. We're going to support schools that let the teachers and the principals try things and innovate, that do things to involve parents, that are succeeding.
The legislation establishes voluntary academic standards for students in several areas in the 4th, 8th, and 11th grades. A Navy panel wants 29 midshipmen expelled from the U.S. Naval Academy for cheating. The recommendation is the result of an inquiry into the largest cheating scandal in the history of the Academy. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
For more than a year now, the Navy has been looking into this cheating scandal in which over 130 midshipmen were implicated. Early reviews by the Honor Review Board determined that a copy of an exam had been stolen and then circulated through an academy dormitory. The original investigation, completed in April of 93, recommended that only 6 midshipmen be expelled. 2 months later, however, the investigation was reopened after those midshipmen who had been dismissed said that they were being used as scapegoats and that many more midshipmen were involved. The Navy Inspector General handled this report. In addition to the 29 recommended for expulsion, 42 others, it says, should be disciplined for honor code violations. That code says no midshipman will lie, cheat, or steal. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
President Clinton is reassuring Americans that the economy is sound and recent drops in the stock market aren't an indicator of serious problems. He says there was a rapid rise in the market at the end of last year, perhaps too large, but he stresses the underlying economy is in good shape. Currently on Wall Street, the Dow is up 10 points at 3,637. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The agreement between the PLO and Israel on Palestinian security in Hebron is being criticized. The plan will deploy 160 international observers in the West Bank town. Some PLO supporters and Muslim militants say the observers will not stop violence. They add, as long as Jewish settlers are there too, there will never be peace. Several hundred Palestinian youths clashed with Israeli police today as the agreement was announced. Police used tear gas and rubber bullets to break up the crowd. The Census Bureau says almost a fifth of American workers take home low pay. The Bureau also says they're most likely to be young people and women. NPR's Barbara Campbell reports.
The government classifies any full-time, year-round worker who makes $13,091 or less as low-paid. The Census Bureau says the number of such workers has gone up 6% since 1979, from 12% to 18%. Census analyst Jack McNeil says the workplace shift toward low-paid jobs hurts young people and women the most, with low-paid young people roughly doubling and women more likely than men to have low-paid jobs. The Bureau says people who hold low-paid jobs tend to have less education than other workers. The threshold earnings level of $13,091 is about 8% below the poverty level for a family of four. The poverty measurement is different because it involves changing consumer prices. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
A Catholic relief group and the United Nations say Haiti's military and a rightist group that supports it are terrorizing the country. The relief groups say the far-right Front for the Advancement and Progress of Haiti was the group that took over Haitian docks last autumn. They prevented a UN team from landing. That team was supposed to be part of an agreement to restore ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have a new clue about how we evolved from our primate ancestors. It was just reported that the first nearly complete skull of our earliest known upright walking ancestor was discovered in Ethiopia. The skull is about 3 million years old. It was uncovered by a team led by paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson. 20 years ago in Ethiopia, he discovered the oldest primate skeleton ever uncovered. He called the skeleton Lucy and concluded that it represented the missing link in evolution between humans and apes. But that skeleton lacked a head, so the conclusions he drew were controversial. Johansson says the recently discovered skull is part of the same species as Lucy and clears up some of the controversy. The skull indicates that Lucy had a small brain, an ape-like jutting jaw, and thick protruding ridges above the eyes. Johansson recently hosted a PBS Nova series and has written a companion book called Ancestors: In Search of Human Origins. Earlier today, he told me what the 3 million-year-old skull adds to our understanding of Lucy's place in evolutionary history.
Well, in 1974, when I found Lucy, she certainly shook up the anthropological world because we determined that she was of extreme antiquity, about 3.2 million years old, and she represented a new kind of human ancestor. In our lingo, a new species belonging to a terrible tongue twister, Australopithecus afarensis. And she precipitated a tremendous amount of debate, and I think to a large extent because most of her skull was missing. We were unable to find the remains of her skull that I suspect were washed away and have broken up and disappeared forever. So 20 years later, with the discovery and now announcement of a skull of her species, we have a solid idea of what those skulls looked like, and it gives us a much better vision of what this earliest human ancestor looked like.
Lucy had been seen as the missing link, the connection between ape and man. How did Lucy revise the theory of human origins?
When I discovered Lucy in 1974, she told us a number of things immediately. If we take a step back and consider even what Charles Darwin said over a century ago, there were three major things that went together in terms of human evolutionary change. One of them was stone tool making, the other was brain expansion, and the third one, which I think is most obvious to all of us, is the acquisition of a new kind of locomotion. Rather than walking around using a stable mode of locomotion like most primates do on four legs, our ancestors stood up and walked on two legs. And Darwin suggested, well, they stood up to make these stone tools, and in order to make those tools, they had to have large brains. Well, Lucy has never been associated with any stone tools. Stone tools don't appear in the archaeological record till at least 750,000 years after Lucy. And Lucy had a very small brain. So what she did, with what we did with this single discovery, was we uncoupled Darwin's trilogy, or trinity, I suppose, that our ancestors stood up and walked in a bipedal fashion long before they began to fashion tools and long before they began to expand their brains.
And I guess the discovery of the skull, which has a small cranium for a small brain, helps to prove that point.
It certainly does. It reinforces the idea. The skull is about 200,000 years younger than Lucy. That's roughly, if we have a 20-year-long generation period, about 10,000 generations younger. And what is astonishing about it, I think in some ways, is that it is still quite primitive. That was one of the most interesting aspects of Lucy, of this species afarensis, that from the neck up, they were very primitive, very ape-like. They had projecting faces. They had a brain about a third the size of our own. They had ape-like teeth, but clearly they were standing upright. Now, this skull that's 200,000 years younger than Lucy is still very primitive. It's a large skull, probably a male, an older male. His teeth were fairly heavily worn, so I suspect that he lived into his late 20s, early 30s. But still had a very projecting face and a very small brain case and strong muscle markings on the skull.
So if this skull and the Lucy skeleton help prove that our primate ancestors walked on 2 feet before they had a developed enough brain to actually use tools, what information does that give us about evolution? Like and about what happened when primates started to walk on 2 feet, how that changed the kinds of lives they led.
Well, two of the areas we're most interested in all evolutionary studies, whether we're studying the evolution of humans or the evolution of horses or antelopes or whatever, are the tempo and mode of evolutionary change. What I mean by that is the speed of evolutionary change and the character that evolutionary change manifests. We know that in terms of the mode of evolutionary change, the first thing that happened in the origins of modern humans, of the human family, was that our ancestors stood up. And I think we'll return to that and talk about that a little bit because it is a very interesting question. And the other thing that we've learned from this skull that's so interesting is that there was apparently a very long period of time, on the order of 1 million years, because this skull has allowed us now to go back and look at some previous discoveries which were made in the early 1980s that were sort of in scientific limbo. We didn't know exactly where they belonged, what species to call them. And because this skull is so complete, about 75 to 80% complete, we were able to look at especially the frontal region, just above the orbits of the eyes, and to look at this 3.9 million-year-old skull fragment, and they're identical. And that means that in terms of the tempo of evolutionary change, the rate of evolutionary change, we're looking at a long period of stability or stasis in a species, Lucy's species, afarensis, that perhaps stretched over 1 million years of time.
That's much slower than we thought.
Well, I think that Darwin's view was a very gradualistic view. He felt that there were very small micro changes that happen each generation. Steve Gould, a colleague of mine at Harvard, and Niles Eldridge at the American Museum of Natural History have suggested, on the basis of literally dozens, maybe hundreds of different species of, whether it be a shell-like thing like a brachiopod or whatever, or a trilobite, that for most of the life of that species, it doesn't change very dramatically. But it's in sort of a state of equilibrium. But something comes along, maybe climatic change, and punctuates that equilibrium. It disturbs that equilibrium. And there are three choices that species make. Not consciously, but there are three different directions that they could go in. They could go extinct if they can't adapt to the new environment. They can adapt and change. Or they can try to follow the old environment as it's moving away. And I think that what we're looking at with this new skull is a very, very important datum at about 3.0 million years ago, which is right on the cusp of a creative of an adaptive explosion that will give rise to several different lineages. And it appears to fit this model of long stasis, rapid change, other periods of stasis, and more rapid change again.
So the rapid change was walking on 2 feet.
Well, the rapid change came, the rapid change I'm talking about is subsequent to this skull, somewhere between 2.5 and 3 million years ago. Walking on two legs is the sort of the major question that I think has captivated people over the last couple of decades, because when we look at it, it's a terrible mode of locomotion. It's slow, it's clumsy. If you're living on the African savanna with a bunch of fast four-legged, you know, quadrupeds, who have one thing and only one thing in mind, to have you for breakfast or supper, it doesn't appear to be a very interesting and successful adaptation. Yet we know that it is a very odd adaptation. There are only two primates that have ever walked upright, ourselves and Lucy-like creatures. So there must have been a tremendous evolutionary payoff, a reproductive advantage for standing upright. And in order to understand that, we have to look back almost 10 to 15 million years ago, when all of Europe, most of Asia, Southeast Asia, and Africa were populated by tens of different kinds of species of apes. Apes were everywhere. It was called the Age of the Apes. And about 10 million years ago, the climate began to change, forests were disappearing, and a much faster primate in terms of reproduction began to take over the scene, and these were the monkeys. Monkeys can reproduce themselves and their mate in about 6 years. A typical African ape today, like a chimpanzee, takes 21 years to reproduce itself and its mate to maintain zero population growth. So if it loses one of those infants when it's 20 years old, it has to start over again. What Owen Lovejoy at Kent State believes is that early hominids now stood up because it enabled them to use their forelimbs, which now become their upper limbs,
their hands,
to carry large amounts of foodstuff back to a home base to share with mates so that females could have more numbers, higher numbers of dependent offspring.
So you think that walking on 2 feet, the evolutionary advantage of that is that you could use your arms and hands. They're free to use tools. They're free to carry food. And then you kind of connect that to the development of like a primate version of nuclear family.
That's right. I think that the carrying, it always sounds very simplistic when we talk about it, but if we look at chimpanzees today, a female chimp will spend almost 60% of her daily foraging time to look for things like termites, insects, small vertebrates. She's looking for protein. She's looking for amino acids. She's looking for fats. And these are incredibly important, even though they only constitute about 5% of her diet. If males and females who were not pregnant, lactating, taking care of offspring, were able to forage widely and carry back larger amounts of high-quality food, thus adding new energy into this social unit, the females that were bearing offspring would be able to have more than at one single time. In other words, they could have a child every couple of years instead of doing it every 6 or 7 years.
Because they'd have more protein?
Because there'd be a lot more energy, you see, because an individual animal has to forage for food for itself, which exposes it to danger, mm-hmm. uses up energy in itself, and makes it difficult to care for offspring. If she can stay in one spot and that high-energy food can be brought to her, she can, in fact, reduce the risk of accident. She can reduce the search time for food. She can use that energy look after her offspring in terms of lactation. She can get pregnant sooner. She can reduce birth spacing, which apes cannot do because they are individually oriented animals.
If you're just joining us, my guest is paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson. He found the skeleton known as Lucy, and that's the oldest anatomical evidence of primates that walked on 2 feet. And now his group has discovered the oldest primate skull. Donald Johansson is also the author of the book Ancestors, In Search of Human Origins. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Back with paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson. His latest discovery, his group found a primate skull that's considered the oldest primate skull ever to be found, about 3 million years old. Would you remember for us the day when you found this skeleton of Lucy?
This was the discovery of Lucy was back in 1974. I hate to admit that it was 20 years ago, but where did those two decades disappear to so fast? I had just gotten my union card, my PhD at the University of Chicago, and I was co-directing with some French colleagues my first major expedition in Africa. I had worked on other expeditions beginning in 1970, but this was really my first major sort of coming out with my doctorate in hand. And it was a Sunday afternoon. I was out surveying with one of my graduate students, Tom Gray, and it was around noon, which means the temperatures were climbing to 110, 120 degrees, and the only thing we were thinking about then was heading back to camp and going for a swim in the river. And there was a small area, really, not much larger than the studio that I'm sitting in here in San Francisco. And it was a patch of ground that for some reason we had ignored during the morning. We had not really taken an in-depth look at it. And as I was walking along, for whatever reason, I looked over my right shoulder and spied on the ground a piece of arm, which was clearly from the elbow region. And as I kneeled down to look at it, I could tell from its diagnostic anatomy that it wasn't a monkey, wasn't an antelope, it couldn't be anything else, it had to be one of these human ancestors. But I wasn't prepared for looking up the slope and seeing a bit of a pelvis, a bit of a leg, a bit of a foot, eroding out. And right there in that noonday sun, I realized, realizing that what we had struck upon was what would ultimately become one of the great finds of the century.
So you realize that you're looking at these positively ancient fossils that are going to be an incredible discovery. And what do you do to protect them as soon as you realize what you've discovered?
Well, the first thing we did after we overcame our excitement, we went to the car, we drove back to camp, we brought the team out and showed them the pieces before they were even touched. And then we took a series of stakes and gridded out in a typical archaeological way the area and systematically collected each square, mapping each bone as it was found, and then put in a small excavation in the hillside and ultimately ended up with nearly 40% of a skeleton that is dated at 3.2 million years. These bones are completely fossilized, completely changed to stone, so they really don't need much care and preparation. We put a thin coating on them of a glue which keeps small pieces of the bone from flaking off. But she's back in Ethiopia now, stored in a safe, nestled in a bed of yellow foam, and those bones are pretty darn stable.
So do you have some kind of cast of Lucy while her real bones are stored in this vault?
Oh, yes. We were able, this was before the laboratory was built in Addis Ababa. There is now a wonderful laboratory at the National Museum where the fossils are all stored and can be worked on. But in the mid-70s, there wasn't a facility like this, and we brought these bones back to the United States. I was director of scientific research at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, and I won't forget that January afternoon landing on an absolutely frozen runway, as they often are at that time of year in Cleveland, with Lucy sitting in a suitcase under the seat in front of me. And here she had come from her ancient resting place in the Horn of Africa to Cleveland, and was stayed there for 5 years when we did all of our studies. We made photographs, we cleaned the specimens, we made molds of them. So we have very excellent casts of the specimen, which can still be used for comparative studies, for example.
Now, are you superstitious, or do you worry a lot? Like, for instance, when you were carrying the fossils onto the plane, did you worry that they were going to make you check it in baggage, you know? That in the cab ride over, there'd be some kind of auto accident, and you'd like, hurt the bones in any way?
It was certainly, she didn't leave my side, whether in the hotel or in the airport or whatever. And the place I was most worried was Paris, because I don't know if you've been through Paris recently, but even back then, everything has to be x-rayed, everything has to be opened up, and the French gendarmes at the airport are very officious about all of this. And one of Lucy's bones, her thigh bone or femur, when it goes through the x-ray machine, invariably looks like a pistol. And most places they didn't say anything, but my worst fears came true in Paris, because this suitcase went through the x-ray machine, and they pulled me aside and they told me that they wanted to open this. And often when they do this, you know, they just sort of rip through things. And I explained to them in not terribly good French that these were very delicate specimens. And he said, well, what are they? And I said, well, they're very old fossils. And this other guy, this older guy, mustached fellow, came over smoking a Gauloise. And he says, could this be Lucy? Because it was in Le Monde, in the newspaper. And when they found out it was Lucy, they wanted to see it even more. So we zippered open this little brown American Tourister bag and took out a couple of pieces. And these Frenchmen said that they will never forget the thrill of holding a 3.2-million-year-old ancestor. And they couldn't do enough for me.
I've read that you've named your fossils Lucy, because you used to play Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds a lot in the camp back in 1974 when you made the discovery. Did you ever wish you'd named her something else?
Absolutely not. I think it's just a wonderful name, and it came up in a serendipitous way. We were listening to a tape. I said, let's call her Lucy, and that's how she got her name.
And do you have to name the skull now?
No, I don't think so. It's got a scientific number, and it's called 444, and I think it's going to stay that way. All of these fossils are so important, because each and every one of them is a link, and a very important link in the sense that it reminds and should remind every reader today who's looking at it in the New York Times or the Philadelphia Inquirer or the San Francisco Chronicle that this is an important link to our past, to our origins, that we, Homo sapiens, got here through the same process as all other life, and that we are still part of the natural world. And if we learn nothing else from this, we need to embrace the idea that we have a common origin, a common beginning, regardless of how people look or act or what color their skin is. We are all from a common beginning. And furthermore, we have to embrace the view that we are part of the natural world. We are now responsible for the outcome of the natural world. And it's my hope that the species, Homo sapiens, will make choices about how we treat and use and care for the natural world that are not just good choices for ourselves, but also for all our fellow travelers.
Donald Johanson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Donald Johanson has written a new book called Ancestors: In Search of Human Origins. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The global economy has meant some bad news for the American tax system. Multinationals are paying less, while smaller businesses are having to pay more, according to a new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Coming up, they share more findings from their new book, America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? And rock and roll historian Ed Ward tells us about his continuing efforts to adjust to life in Berlin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Thousands of Jewish settlers have demonstrated near the West Bank town of Hebron. They're protesting Israel's peace moves with the PLO and government plans to deploy international observers in the town. Miriam Hirschlag reports from Jerusalem.
The Jewish settlers and their supporters rallied to protest moves toward compromise with the Palestinians and to proclaim, in their words, Hebron always and forever. Citing security concerns, the Israeli army blocked the protesters from demonstrating in Hebron itself, the volatile West Bank town where last month Baruch Goldstein gunned down Palestinian worshippers. At the demonstration held in the nearby settlement of Kiryat Arba, songs of praise for Goldstein could be heard in the crowd. Right-wing speakers called for a campaign of civil disobedience in the event the government tries to remove Jewish settlers from their homes. And several rabbis said it would be a sin for soldiers to follow orders to evacuate Jews from anywhere within the biblical boundaries of Israel. For National Public Radio, I'm Miriam Hirschlag in Jerusalem.
Shipping authorities say 2 million gallons of crude oil have been spilled in the Persian Gulf. Two supertankers collided at the Gulf's entrance and the oil started to pour into the sea. The accident is just off the United Arab Emirates. The spill has been contained. Authorities are looking into the cause of the accident. The International Committee of the Red Cross says one of its relief workers has been kidnapped today by Somali gunmen in a shootout. His Somali assistant has been killed. Anne Stingle is a spokeswoman for the Red Cross.
We don't know at this point who has him or why. It happened at 2 o'clock Mogadishu time, which was 6 o'clock in the morning our time, and we have not been told what the reason was behind this, or there has been no ransom or anything demanded. However, the Red Cross at this point has no reason to believe that he's not safe.
The South African president has declared an emergency in Natal province. This is intended to calm Zulu residents' unrest and fear over upcoming all-race elections. The state of emergency gives police and the military broad powers. They can stop rallies and marches that have been blamed for sparking violence. The African National Congress is accusing the Zulu-dominated Inkatha Freedom Party of trying to upset the election. Los Angeles authorities say murder charges can be filed soon against two suspects in the carjacking deaths of two students from Japan. Police say they're holding two men in connection with the case. L.A. Police Chief Willie Williams says murder, robbery, and other charges will be filed in the next day or so. On Wall Street today, stock trading was mixed. The Dow made a late recovery to advance almost 9.25 points. It ended the day at 3,635. Decliners led advances by a margin of 2-1 in extremely heavy trading. This is NPR. Russia is re-examining its decision to join NATO's Partnership for Peace agreement. Russian authorities say they must define Moscow's role in the new partnership and address Russia's needs first. A spokesman for President Boris Yeltsin says the partnership program has to be looked at more closely. The spokesman says Moscow is troubled that it could give up its freedom to act in military and diplomatic areas where it has an interest. Russia has recently acted strongly in helping to mediate conflicts in Bosnia and the Middle East, as well as the potential nuclear trouble in North Korea. The New Jersey Supreme Court has upheld an East Brunswick ordinance banning all cigarette vending machines in the community. Gene Dillard reports from Trenton. It's the first such ordinance in the country.
East Brunswick enacted the cigarette vending machine ban in 1990 because of concern about the impact tobacco was having on its young people. Local officials cited figures showing 22% of 13-year-olds who smoke regularly get cigarettes from vending machines, and two-thirds of all high school students use the machines for their tobacco products. The court said the township has the right to protect the health and welfare of its residents. Regina Carlson, executive director of the Group Against Smoking Pollution, is pleased.
We hope this gives a green light to towns to go ahead and enact laws to protect children from the tobacco companies.
Attorneys for the vending machine companies believe the ruling could lead to a prohibition on over-the-counter cigarette sales or even to a total ban on cigarettes, and they plan to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
The government says the economy expanded by 7% in the fourth quarter of last year. The report on the gross domestic product is 0.5% lower than first estimated. The GDP is the sum of all goods and services produced in the United States. The Commerce Department also says an inflation index for the fourth quarter found that inflation was running at an annual rate of 1.3%. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There's just a little over 2 weeks left to file your income tax. The only thing more confusing than our tax code is figuring out why on earth it's so confusing. Investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele have some answers in their new book, America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? They're also the authors of the bestseller, America, What Went Wrong? About the Disappearing Middle Class. Bartlett and Steele's new book analyzes the inequities of our tax system. Yesterday, we talked about how the tax burden has been shifted from the wealthiest to the middle class. Bartlett and Steele say the tax burden is also being shifted in the business world, from the largest corporations to smaller ones.
There's an absolute shift there, and it's a very dramatic one and a very steady one that goes back really 40 years. Starts 40 years ago. But it's accelerated dramatically in recent years. You go back to the 50s. Think of the income taxes, all of them, corporate and individual, as a big pie. Back in the 1950s, corporations paid roughly 39% of that pie. By the 80s, they were down to 18%. This is what the corporate share had declined to. That meant individuals, from middle-income people to the very wealthy, everybody on that side of the ledger had to make up the rest of that. What accounts for this shrinking percentage? The significance of this to us is that you hear so much about how corporate America is paying so much, how its tax burden is very high. That very often is true with some small businesses, by the way. But with the overall, the larger corporation, it's quite often not the situation. What accounts for this? And we looked into this. In addition to a number of the write-offs that have been part of the tax code for a long time, one of the most dramatic reasons why some companies are paying less today than they did in the past is that they are simply paying more to foreign governments than their own. Corporations that once paid more to the U.S. and less abroad, it's now a reverse situation.
This is the multinationals you're talking about?
Multinational. I mean, Coca-Cola is an example. There's 7 out of 10 of Coca-Cola's income tax dollars go abroad. Only 3 of those 10
stay
here.
You can look at a company like Black & Decker, which is a familiar name to everybody. From the period 1990 to 92 we looked at, 4% of their money was paid in U.S. income tax. 96% went to foreign governments. Exxon, 23% to the U.S., all the rest to foreign governments. Ford Motor Company, 40% U.S., 60% foreign governments. Now, the argument obviously is going to be, well, that's where their sales are. Their sales are outside the United States, which is fine, and they should pay those taxes. The problem is the tax code has not been changed to take into account this shifting of tax revenue, and we're still operating under a tax code that was written at a time when corporations paid the largest percentage of their taxes in this country. And this is further complicated by the fact that foreign-owned companies doing business in the U.S. pay taxes at a much lower rate than U.S. companies.
If multinationals are paying more to foreign governments than they are to ours, is that because they're doing more business abroad? And would the solution to be to try to keep them doing more business here, or is the solution tax incentives to stay?
Well, that's an interesting question. Part of it is that they are indeed manufacturing overseas and shipping products from their overseas locations. It's an area that really needs to be studied.
We're not advocating restricting their ability to do that. That's not the point. I think what we're saying is that there are a whole series of things available to a multinational that is not available to basically a U.S.-based company. One of those is this issue of transfer pricing. You can adjust your books to deal with your best of all possible tax situations. The other irony is that many foreign companies simply have a higher, or countries have a higher tax rate than we do, which is ironic when you view this debate about U.S. corporate taxes being so high. We obviously can't control that, but it needs to be said in light of the notion that we're paying, that corporations are paying so much here.
And what's significant about that, and that in those cases, that means U.S. taxpayers are indirectly subsidizing the taxes of foreign governments.
Isn't this something we're just stuck with in the global economy?
No. This is this buzz phrase of the 1990s that we've heard so much about it. Everything is just dismissed. Well, that's the global economy, and that's what we have to do. But this clearly is not true. Just as there is no reason for inequities in the individual side of the tax code, there is no reason for inequities in the corporate side of the tax code. Once again, these are the people with the greatest access to Congress who are going to get the tax laws written in the way they want them and not in the way that serve the best interest of the country at large or of business at large for that matter. Because as Jim indicated, small businesses and medium-sized businesses do not have these options. They are stuck with the taxes they pay, whereas with the multinationals, taxes are often optional as to where they pay them or how they pay them.
Conversely, every time you see in this country an attempt to tax foreign corporations operating here so that they might pay comparable rates to what a similar U.S. corporation would pay here. There's a hue and cry, like this will frighten off business, this will frighten off foreign investment. But the net result of it is even those companies are not paying here what U.S. corporations, both domestic and of a multinational sort, pay.
Many of these foreign-owned companies doing business in the U.S. pay taxes well below the rate of a middle-income family.
My guests are Donald Bartlett and James Steele, investigative reporters with the Philadelphia Inquirer and co-authors of the new book, America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about inequities in our tax system with Donald Bartlett and James Steele. And going back to the theme that the tax burden has shifted, you say another example is that it shifted from the federal government to the state and local governments. State and local governments have to raise more revenue to compensate.
This is right. And this is a combination of things. Many programs that the federal government once took on, they've shifted to the states, and they've told states and local jurisdictions, now you pay for these. The bottom line on all of this, though, and this is a great point, and this is why there's so much frustration over taxes. It's not just at the federal level. It's the combination of what people are paying at the federal level and the state and local level, because state and local taxes have been going up at a much sharper rate than federal taxes. And the reason for that is because so many of these things have been shifted to the local level. And what's happened is, and this is why the middle income group is being hit so hard, because state and local taxes everywhere are very regressive, meaning they weigh hardest on middle-income, lower-income people. The federal system, for all its imperfections, has some degrees of progressivity in it even now, not like it did a few years ago. But compared to most states, I mean, it's a model of equity, because most states, even states that have income taxes, and many of them, Pennsylvania, of course, is one example of one that has a flat tax. Many other states have graduated rates, but you reach the top rate very quickly, $8,000, $9,000, $15,000. In other words, somebody who is let's say, a fast food worker in a state like Missouri is paying almost the same rate that somebody like an August Bush is paying, the Anheuser-Busch family, because that rate is approached so quickly. And that is the story in many states that have income taxes. They are not true income taxes. They're, in effect, flat taxes that weigh heavily on middle-income people.
And, you know, we're not sure that people understand sometimes also just how regressive a sales tax is. I mean, if you use as an example a family with an income of $30,000 a year buys a Ford Escort for $10,000, that family has paid 2% of its income in state sales tax. But a family with $1 million in income buys a Continental and it pays 0.2%. The middle-income family has contributed 8 times as much of its income to the support of state government as the wealthier family has. And people tend not to think about that when you're talking in terms of sales tax. But if you were to put that ratio into an income tax and say, here's what we're going to do for you as a family with making $30,000, you're going to be taxed at a rate of 9% on your income, and if you make $1 million, you're going to be taxed at 1%. How many people would buy that? But yet that's what a sales tax does.
States and cities, I think, are in some ways competing with each other to see who can have the lowest corporate taxes so that they can help use that to woo businesses to move there. And places are so desperate now to bring in companies, both for the tax dollars that the companies will pay and also for the jobs it's going to generate. So what kind of havoc is that creating, this competition to woo companies through taxes?
This is a form of, you might say, tax roulette when the gun is aimed right at the American middle class. And this is another step in this process. This is going on everywhere. For a long time, states have competed against each other. Particularly southern states have been trying to lure plants from the north for years and years for a whole range of reasons. So there's nothing on its face exactly new about the process. But what's happened is the whole thing has escalated way beyond what it was just a few years ago. Now you see, even within metropolitan areas, a tremendous amount of competition for suburban areas trying to lure institutions out of a city. You find even within a state, one county vying with another. You find within regions, one state vying with another to get a plant. When you look at every one of those individual situations, you say, well, what's a governor to do or what's a mayor to do to deal with this process? And the fact of the matter is most of them have a gun pointed at their head. There's not a whole lot they can do or they feel they'll get blamed. But the bottom line of it means this continuing, ongoing shifting of the tax obligation in those jurisdictions to medium-income families.
There's a proposal that a subcommittee passed that cigarette packages, each pack of cigarettes should be taxed $1.25, which is it's a hefty tax.
Sure.
Now, I know we're all against smoking, and smokers are exiles now from their homes and offices. But what do you think of a tax like that from the perspective of fairness?
Well, if the idea is to make people stop smoking, then what happens when they all stop smoking? What happens to that tax base? It just strikes us as not a very secure tax base.
We also think that this is an illustration of, and your point on fairness I think is very good, but it's also an illustration why we're still in this mode where we really don't want to talk about taxes at all. So you want to pick out something over here that's on the fringe that affects a few people. And while there is a big, powerful lobby in the tobacco industry and so forth, essentially the people involved is getting smaller and smaller each year, as opposed to doing something across the board with the income tax, which is still the fairest and most equitable way to raise money overall, assuming you have progressive graduated rates. We're doing everything in this country to avoid looking at the income tax, because nobody likes to pay taxes, and we're all in sympathy with that problem. I mean, everybody agrees with it, but it's still, in many ways, the fairest of all taxes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you are particularly paranoid people or not, but it wouldn't take much paranoia, because this is the way people think about auditing, for you to think, well, now that you've tried to investigate the tax system, surely you're going to be audited. A lot of people see auditing as a punishment for doing something that might be perceived as threatening to the tax system or to the government or whatever. Is there any truth in that? And do you think you'd be audited for writing your book?
No. I think also this is a book really, it's aimed at Congress, not IRS.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, IRS, and we've written about IRS over the years. I mean, one of our early series was about IRS. And IRS is an easy target because much of what they do, they are told to do by Congress. And the real culprit here is Congress. It is not IRS.
I mean, the complexity that we are all angry about is a result of the tax legislation derby on Capitol Hill. IRS must live with that legacy. So we don't view them as the principal problem here.
Is there ever retribution behind the decision to audit somebody?
Well, I'm sure in probably some cases there may be. And you know, we've run across cases of that sort. But again, at the heart of it, though, is this complexity. And that's where you see, even with IRS, operates at a certain disadvantage. Half the time, you cannot tell what the law means and intends. And in fact, when the laws are passed, then Treasury and IRS have to get together to issue regulations Sometimes these projects take years to complete because they debate what Congress intended and what should be the final word of the law. So this gets to the heart of this complexity of the system.
What makes this complexity work for Congress is you can think of it as a bank. Whenever they need money, all they've got to do is propose a tax rule change, and millions of dollars will pour into the House Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee and campaign contributions and speakers' fees. I mean, the money just floods into Washington. And that's probably the overriding reason that Congress will not enact a simplified tax law. It is money in the bank. The complex law is money in the bank.
So you are not worried about being audited?
No.
No.
Have you done your tax returns yet?
working on it mightily.
Can we talk about your next subject here?
Any final words you have for our listeners who are still facing filling out their taxes and have to brace themselves for the bills that they're about to pay?
Well, I think when they fill out that tax form and they get to some of the various forms that are complex, that are difficult mm-hmm. to navigate their way through, I think they should realize that it's not them, it's not some deficiency on their part. I mean, this is the way the system has been designed, and it doesn't have to be this way. And they will be maddest, angriest at IRS because of that, because they're looking at the IRS form. But again, it is a product of a system created largely by Congress, by a number of administrations that IRS and all of us must live with. I don't think I'm sure IRS would love to have that thing simplified for a whole range of reasons. And I know the rest of us would. So when they do that, realize there is a way around that. And the next time they hear a congressman or a senator say, "We want to simplify the tax code," go turn to their last year's tax return to just see how well they've done it in the past.
And when they get to line 53, which says, "This is your total tax," don't be mad at IRS. Be mad at Congress. If you make more than, say you make $45,000 and you pay more than $263, you're paying at a higher tax rate than a wealthy investor in Kuwait who gets all of his money from his U.S. investments. Actually, if you make $25,000 a year and pay more than $15 in income tax, you're paying at a higher rate than an investor in the United Arab Emirates who invests in the United States. And that's courtesy of Congress.
And that's to encourage foreign investment?
It's to take care of people.
Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Donald Bartlett and James Steele are investigative reporters with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Their new book is called America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what are some of the stories you're following on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tonight I'll talk with the president of a company that makes what has often been called the world's deadliest handgun. It's the Desert Eagle 50 Magnum. It's made in Israel for a Minnesota-based company. The pistol weighs 4 pounds and costs more than $1,200. Also, Ira Glass, once again, goes back to Taft High School in Chicago, this time to learn about the difficulty of trying to keep handguns out of the school. NPR's Ann Cooper reports on the new state of emergency in Natal Province in South Africa. And letters from listeners about Whitewater, both saying we're covering the story too much and too little.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Fresh Air's rock and roll historian Ed Ward recently moved to Berlin. You can imagine some of the challenges of relocating there, learning a new language, figuring out how to get around. But one of the biggest challenges he's faced has been shopping.
Sunday morning, I got up and stumbled to the bathroom to shave. I pushed the light switch and pow, the bulb blew. "Here we go again," I said as I shaved in the dark. Last week it was flour. I was making an American dinner and realized I didn't have quite enough for the cornbread. The flour only took 3 hours to find. The bathroom light was going to be out all day. Now, Sunday store closing is no big thing. After all, when I moved to Texas 13 years ago, there were blue laws, and only recently has Britain allowed shops to open on Sunday. But if it had been, say, 8 o'clock on Friday night and I'd needed that flour or light bulb, I'd have been equally out of luck. And that, more than trying to learn German or find my way through the subway system, has been the biggest adjustment I've had to make here. It's the weird German law concerning shop hours. 7 till 6:30 weekdays, although most close at 6, Thursdays till 8, although few take advantage of it, Saturdays until 2, although most close at 1, until 4, or maybe 6, the first Saturday of each month. Got it? I sure didn't. It was only when I discovered that I was eating out far more than I wanted to, or could afford, that I knew I had to find a way to cope. That was when I first started noticing the plastic bags. Everywhere I went during the day, people were carrying plastic bags because, like me, they were taking off time in their workday to do the shopping most Americans would do after work. That was also why, when we set up our office, there was a mad dash to find a used refrigerator, not, as I'd assumed, to keep beer in, but to have a place to store our vegetables and milk until it was time to go home. A friend of mine who worked the traffic beat at a radio station here told me that most traffic accidents happen in the 45 minutes before closing time as people rush through Berlin's insanely congested streets to get to the store on time. There are ways around this, of course. Most Saturdays, the Turkish vegetable stands pretty much ignore the closing time, and in my neighborhood, a Turkish family with a kind of 7-Eleven leaves a few cans of cat food outside their door to indicate that they're open, usually until about 9. And special licenses are available. There's a very expensive but well-stocked supermarket in the Friedrichstrasse railway station that's open late, and even on Sundays, and a bakery shop elsewhere in the terminal with the same hours. You can buy bread there on Sundays. Another kink in the law says that bakeries can open for a few hours on Sunday to sell cakes, but not bread. And flower shops open for 2 hours on Sunday in case you're going to visit your mother. Another lifesaver is the gas station. Open 24 hours to service taxis and other night owls, they've moved from selling cigarettes and potato chips to having well-stocked mini-markets in them. So I work with one eye on the clock and a prayer to Allah for the Turks if I don't make the supermarket on time. And if all else fails, a friend who's lived here for a long time notes, this is the only city in Europe where you can get a drink 24 hours a day.
Ed Ward is currently living in Berlin and writing for Checkpoint magazine. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.